you are about to see the first public exhibition of an entirely new form of entertainment.
That belongs in a museum.
You are about to see the first public exhibition of an entirely new form of entertainment.
That belongs in a museum.
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of Treasury Cast, the show that celebrates the greatest comics format of all time, the Treasury Edition. Proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network, I'm your host, Rob Kelly, and joining us once again is my pal, Dallin Baumgarten. Hi, Dallin.
Hello, sir.
I'm happy to have you back on the show.
I'm happy to be back. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Now, it's been a little while, and the previous Treasury that we covered was Marvel Treasury Edition, The Defenders. And we've got some more Defenders this time around. We're talking about Marvel Treasury Edition number 12, Howard the Duck. before we get into the details of this particular comic, you've been on the show before, Down, so I know about your history with the Treasury format, but either growing up, either as a kid or now, where are you on Howard the Duck? Are you a particular fan?
I am a fan. I love Howard more and more. I've been slowly sort of reading the whole Howard library over the last couple of years, mostly collecting and slowly reading. I only had a couple of Howard issues when I was a kid, and I don't, it's hard to remember back if they were on the spinner rack and I chose other comics or if they weren't there. I think the early issues probably weren't there.
Probably.
And, I did have a couple, and yeah, it was a little over my head when I was a kid. I didn't truly appreciate, Howard or Gerber.
Yeah.
My first issue of Howard was when Howard was in an insane asylum and the rock group Kiss shows up. they made an appearance on the last page of the previous issue, which I didn't have, but. Yeah, so I don't remember if I bought that issue because Kiss was in it. Like I opened it up and I was like, whoa. Or if I just randomly grabbed it because it was the first Howard I ever saw. I don't remember that. But I remember it was a little wild for my young brain.
Considering your future career as a musician, having Kiss show up in the comic is like where Batman is looking for what should I become? And then a bat flies through his window.
Right?
It's like, oh, perfect.
Yeah, and then that appearance of Kiss, I think that was their first comic book appearance, that predated the Marvel Super Special, which I still to this day don't own, and it keeps me up at night sometimes.
All the trip, we should explain to people who don't know, one of the things that you have done in your career as a musician is when you're touring, you have stopped in local comic shops and, fill holes in your collection. So I can't believe all the places you've been to, you've never come across the Kiss special, or at the very least at a price that you were willing to pay?
No. I think the only time maybe I've ever seen it was at a convention when it was not a price I was willing to pay.
Wow. Okay.
I've wanted it for so many years.
Maybe someday. Maybe someday you'll end up with that Kiss special. That
wait a minute. I just want to clarify real quick, though. This is Treasury. This is Treasury Cast.
Yes.
Oh, I have my Yoo-hoo right here. Can you hear this? Listen to this satisfying pop. I've got my Yoo-hoo, and I had put my bug repellent on, and I guess I thought maybe we were doing Mountain Comics, and then
No, Mountain Comics is done for the year. We'll be back next year, but we're okay. Falling to the fall season, so now we're back here on Treasury Cast.
That's fine. I'm not going to let this Yoo-hoo go to waste, though.
No. Hey, Treasury Comics and Yoo-hoo go together just fine.
Oh, that's good.
Really great.
That's
so, good stuff. All right, so so let's talk about Marvel Treasury Edition number 12. It was on sale October 5th, 1976. It features a great cover by Gene Colan and Tom Palmer, that's redundant, of course, of Howard jumping into the camera, flanked by members of the Defenders. We've got Doctor Strange, Hulk, Nightwing, and Valkyrie, and it even talks about that it features a brand new adventure. starring the Defenders. Now, I think it says something about Howard's meteoric rise as a star of Marvel Comics that by number 12, he was already getting his own Treasury Edition when the previous stars of Marvel Treasury Edition had been the Marvel workhorses, Spider-Man, Thor, Fantastic Four, Conan, the Avengers, Hulk, and yet Howard the Duck, who'd only been around not even a year, already got a Treasury Edition. That says something amazing about how fast and how popular he became, that they figured he could headline his own Treasury book when he had barely been around.
Yeah, I don't get it. I mean, I had only been into comics a couple of years, but, you know, so I sort of lived through the Howard, you know, meteoric rise, as it were, but I still don't understand it. The Part more I read about it, the you know, I think it was just such a weird, just the weird time and place, you know?
I mean, I think part of it was driven by the Howard the Duck number one, which was famously underprinted. Somehow it got like people and newsstand vendors had like shorted it or something. And so it became you just mentioned that you never saw Howard the Duck on your newsstand. I didn't either. I think it was a book that so it was the kind of thing where I think there was like a sort of unnatural sort of short selling of it almost. Like it created a demand that wasn't really there. I mean, Howard the Duck went on for a couple of years, but it wasn't like it went on forever. It got canceled around number 31. So it wasn't like Howard was the next Star Wars or anything like that.
I remember when Howard the Duck number one was going for like $20.
In 1970s money, yeah.
Yeah, I was like, whoa, 20, oh man. But, you know, so Howard appeared in Fear,
right?
And Man-Thing. And from what Steve Gerber said, Marvel wanted Howard gone. Howard disappeared as quickly as he showed up. And he said that he needed something to be even more absurd than what he had already put in the book. And he didn't know how to get that absurd. So he thought, what if a duck walked out, you know? So Marvel wanted Howard out of the book. So he killed Howard like almost immediately. Well, he didn't kill him, but he disappeared immediately.
Yep.
And apparently the fans loved Howard, you know, mm-hmm. and they made it known. And so Marvel gave him another shot to bring him back as a backup. So the whole thing is just weird, the way, you know, that he sprung out and he disappeared, then he came back, then he got his own book. It was bi-monthly, then it was monthly. You know, before you knew it, he was running for president. Like,
yeah,
it was,
which they talk about, right, in this book.
Yeah, it was brilliant.
It was brilliant. He had his own, within a very short period of time, he had his own magazine and a comic strip. I mean,
and a comic strip.
I mean, my Lord. I mean, that's just, and of course, you know, later on, he would be the first ever Marvel movie. We could talk about that if we want to, maybe not.
We're going to talk about it.
So, what do you think of this cover by Colin and Palmer? We've got Howard the Duck with the Defenders coming out. What's your feelings on this?
Overall, I love it. You know, it's obviously literally jumping out at you, and I think it's great. But there's also something very strange about this cover, because this is not a Treasury I had as a kid. I got this, you know, quite a few years back, whatnot, but not that many years ago. And I don't know if my copy is a little bit faded from what the original colors were, but the way that the walls are a light yellow.
Mm-hmm.
And the background is like a white.
Yeah, that's what mine looks like.
It's a weird mix of shades. it's there's something just a little off-putting about it to me. But I don't know if you have the same feeling. But just that weird yellow that looks like maybe it should have been white, but it's not, or maybe it should be brighter. But you know, all the characters stand out, and that's the important thing. So
I think that's what it is. Yeah, they wanted it to really pop with the heroes coming up. But yeah, it is. It's generally a lighter tone that you would normally see in a Marvel comic in the 70s, where everything was bright colors all the time. We'll even talk about the back cover. This is not a wraparound cover, but it is a mirror imaged front and back cover. We'll talk about that when we get to it. So on the inside cover, there is a bunch of photos of Howard at a convention with people supposedly saying Howard signs, because there was this whole Howard the Duck for President thing that was going on at the party. Time. Yeah. Yeah. And you've got Stanley Presents, and even got says Stanley in Stars and Stripes kind of font. So, I mean, they're really leaning into this very, very hard. So the first story is called The Duck and the Defenders, and it is by Steve Gerber, of course, and John Buscema and Sal Buscema, excuse me, and Klaus Janson. And like I said, this is an all new story. This is original to Marvel Treasury. So you're going to forgive me, everybody. You're going to have to for these plot descriptions, because trying to write out plot synopses for Howard the Duck stories feels a little silly after a while because of the absurdity, the built-in absurdity to these stories. But bear with me, everybody. So this opens with a group of five self-described loser supervillains assembling in Central Park. After fighting off some members of the NYPD, their leader, Dr. Angst, tells them that their surest route to fame and fortune is to go after a famous name. In this case, recently minted presidential candidate Howard the Duck. Meanwhile, across town, Howard and Bev, needing a place to stay, stumble their way to the Greenwich Village townhouse that is the home of Dr. Stephen Strange. Visiting Strange are his fellow defenders, who are only slightly surprised to be visited by a talking duck. Soon after, Angst and his villains attack. Dr. Strange is overwhelmed, but not before he transports all the combatants to a nearby football field so the ensuing fight is not to completely destroy the neighborhood. He also transfers his powers to Howard, who briefly becomes the master of the mystic arts. The baddies are quickly defeated, and everyone returns to the Sanctum Sanctorum. Exhausted from the fisticuffs, Howard asks Dr. Strange if he can loan Howard a buck for a bus uptown. All right. All right. So, Dan, like I said, the last time you were on Treasury Cast, we were talking about the Defenders Treasury Edition, and now here we are with the Defenders again. What do you think of this story?
It's a mixed bag to me. Steve Gerber is kind of hit and miss from one story to the next, it seems like. But I also feel like he's a little hit and miss from one panel to the next. Like, overall, I enjoy the story. It's a lot of fun. It is absurd. And there were times in my comic consuming past when, you know, I was more or less into absurdist stories, but you know, at my age, I think this is a hoot.
I mean, Gerber is so having fun with the Marvel conventions at this point.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, I think the Marvel Universe is really only 14 years old at this point, not that long into its creation, and he is just—I don't want to say he's not crapping on it, but he's really making fun of it and the inherent silliness. And I'm kind of amazed almost that the Marvel. I guess it was the fact we've all read the stories about. In the 70s, Marvel was really freewheeling. I mean, they were just, things were run by a wing and a prayer, and a lot of writers got to kind of do whatever they wanted because there was almost nobody at the switch to pay. It was almost like, are you getting it done on time? Fine. Other than that, that was the extent of how much it was looked at. But I mean, I love this intro of these villains, Sitting Bullseye, Tilly the Hun, the Spanker, Black Hole. I mean, you know, in another Marvel comic, these would be genuine villains, but under Gerber, it's all just absurdist and ridiculous. And it is funny to see. I mean, Spider-Man even shows up in this story. Well, excuse me, Peter Parker shows up in this story. And I'm just kind of amazed that Marvel would sort of allow their heroes to get dragged into this universe where it's all so absurd. I mean, it's just all so silly and just, again, taking the piss out of all of the conventions of the Marvel Universe. But thanks to the artwork by Buscema and Janson, which is, you know, great. I'm a huge fan of Klaus Janson as an inker. I just think he brings, I love the line he brings to everybody, but he really works well with Sal Buscema. Thanks to Sal Buscema, one of the real workhorses of the Marvel artist stable, it reads like a genuine quote unquote Marvel comic. I think if you were a kid, you wouldn't really pick up how bizarre this all is, because it reads kind of like a Defenders comic.
Yeah, I mean, most people tend to argue that Gerber's Defenders run was the best. You know, that was like the defining Defenders. And if you think about the history of this character, if Marvel really wanted him to abandon this duck idea, but the fans cried out for it, then why not lean into the absurdity of it, right? I mean, and that's what he's doing. I mean, he's just, every panel is just like a different opportunity for him to take some little thing and skewer it, you know. And I mean, there's probably some vaguely racist moments in the beginning of the story, you know, but nothing is spiteful, you know, nothing. Gerber's just having fun. And he's just, what can I throw at the wall? What's going to stick in this next page?
I love how this, this villain, the black hole, whose power is that he opens up a black hole in his chest and he sucks everything in and people get sucked into it. And I love how everybody's like, ew, like they're kind of like, oh, yes. This is kind of
everyone's
gross.
Like, oh, that guy's, oh, I don't like that guy.
And there's even a point at the end of the story where after a black hole has absorbed a couple of NYPD guys, Dr. Strange reverses his powers. And there's a panel where Black Hole is just standing there with this cop just like chest deep, just leaning out of Black Hole's chest. Yeah. And it's just absurd. Like you're like, ew. It's just nasty.
I love that he made that little point of letting you know, like, oh, okay, they didn't die.
They go to some portal. Yeah, they go to some dimension somewhere.
Yeah.
I mean, there's
one panel where he says, he says, I feel like I could suck in a horse.
Yeah.
Wait, what? Okay. I'm glad there's a couple extra words in there.
And you've got, you've got the paddler whose job, who's literally paddles people on the rear end with his paddle. That's his power. I mean, so yeah, it really, it's, he's able, you know, they wander into sort of a Howard universe a little, although of course this is not a Howard, you know, this is a Howard Treasury, but I mean, it's sort of a co-story, but I mean, like there's a part near the end too, where, Bev, where Howard thinks about that he wants to dump Bev at one point, and she's worried. She was so worried that he was gone, and she hugs him. And then Howard goes, "I knew it. I knew she'd go all lachrymose on me." I mean, what other writer is putting the word lachrymose in a comic book story?
There's several references in this story that I had to look into. When the is it tennis balls that go flying around, and Nighthawk says, let me find this real quick. It's when the villain attacks and there's tennis balls flying all over the Doctor Strange's room. Nighthawk says, sounds like two Stigas in a grudge match. Or Stigas.
Yeah, I don't know what that means.
I was trying to find out, and like there's like a Swedish company that makes lawnmowers. And I found there was a ping pong table called a Stigas ping pong table. And I don't know if the same company, but it just sounds like maybe at the time that was, if there's tennis balls flying around, then maybe it's a ping pong table reference. Two ping pong tables in a grudge. I don't know. It's a little bit.
Right, because they have the sound effect of the thakada, 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 because Doctor Strange opens up that orb, and then all these balls come flying out, tennis balls come flying out, and they're bopping all around, and that's what knocks out Doctor Strange, which gets him sort of out of the action.
Speaking of balls,
continue.
The characters are constantly talking about possessing spheres, like that's his way of saying they, you know, they don't have any balls or something. Like
you know, Gerber's just having a lot of fun, you know, this. He's just having an absolute lot of fun. And it's great that this Treasury features an original story. Like that's, you know, Marvel didn't do a whole ton of that in the beginning. And so it's nice. It's nice. I always love the Defenders.
When the Treasuries did have their own little, you know, original story, that just made it so much better.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. It's a great way to kick off the Treasury. So and after that, there is a bonus feature where is a the original version of a cover layout for Howard the Duck number 8, where Howard is bursting through a newspaper and it says Howard for President,
which is cool too, because that is just like a cover layout. That wasn't the actual finished cover. They
right.
Changed it. So that's a nice little, you know, fun little extra. I love that.
Yeah. I thought that was cool.
It didn't even end up being the actual cover.
Yep. So then the next story is The Way It All Began from Fear number 19 by Steve Gerber. These are all going to be by Gerber, of course. Val Merrick and Sal Trapani. So finding themselves mysteriously trapped across dimensions to Earth, Howard the Duck and the sword-wielding savage known as Korik decide to team up so they can try and find a way home. Soon, however, they are drawn into a battle alongside the Man-Thing against a horde of demons. After defeating them, Howard and the others are summoned to an interdimensional portal. Howard slips and falls, headed to parts unknown. Now, there is way more to this story than that summary would suggest, but I actually got exhausted trying to write the plot synopsis for this thing.
Well, it's a conglomeration of panels from a few different issues.
Yep.
And they've successfully, you know, just given you a little bit of, you know, it's just sort of the Cliff's Notes version of Howard's beginnings. And it's great because they've got his whole origin is just packed in here with very little Man Thing. But it's a great introduction to the character. If you've missed all those early issues, they just kind of crammed it all together.
Yeah, I read this thing like it's a short story. It's only about 10 pages. And I read it, I think, 4 or 5 times trying to write out synopses. And I was like, I just can't write all this. Like, it was like, there's this character, then this character, then this. And then I was like, okay, Man-Thing shows up with this guy, Korik. I don't know who Korik is. He fights a demon that can pull his body apart. And he attacks him with like a bit, you know, like a severed leg and a severed arm. Then the Man-Thing shows up. And then there's this other character appears. And then they go to this interdimensional thing. I was like, oh, my Lord, this is just so much work. And there's even an intro. This is something Gerber would use a lot, like a text conversation back and forth. And it's literally just written out in text form, which is, again, Gerber would do this a couple different times. You got to wonder, again, how did he sort of get away with this? Because I can't imagine a comic today doing that. But, again, it was the 70s, and I think it was just like, all right, just it's fine. No, it's-
the loonies were definitely running the asylum.
Yep.
I mean, Steve Gerber, I guess he was sort of friends with Roy Thomas. They were both sort of like fanzine guys. Mm-hmm. And when he was doing like copyright work and he told Thomas, like, I can't take this anymore. And so Thomas brought him out to be an editor. And supposedly he kept falling asleep and he couldn't be an effective editor. So they took away his editing duties and he just became a writer. But it sounds like, you know, they were buddies and they'd just be like, just go for it, man. Just, we got to get the work done. Just do it.
So, and this story leads directly into the next story. Said it ends with Howard falling off the sort of platform into another dimension. And the other characters are like, can't we chase him? And the wizard's like, no, you can't follow him. So now we're going to follow where Howard goes in the next story, which is,
any sense.
No, it doesn't. It's from Giant Size Man Thing, everybody's favorite, number 4, Frog Death by Gerber and Frank Brunner. So this feels Howard. This features that Howard falls to Earth, landing in Cleveland. He meets some neighborhood kids who introduce him to a strange guy who lives down the street, a drunk named Garko. Except Garko is more than what he appears to be. After drinking some sort of magic potion, he's transformed into Garko the Man Frog, who goes on a rampage. Making like Conan the Barbarian with a garbage can lid and a pointed stick, Howard fights the beast off long enough for the transformation to continue, turning Garko from a man-frog hybrid into a real-world frog, eventually wanting to drop world conquering for a nice dip in a pond. The cops arrest Howard as Garko hops away right under the wheels of the cop car where he is squished. So all right, Dal, so what did you think of Frog Death?
It's not my favorite Howard the Duck story, but it's just, he's just getting his feet wet with this character. And
no pun intended.
You know. But, yeah, it's a fun story. I like the art.
The artwork is marvelous by Frank Brunner.
More than I like the actual story. But, again, it's not really about the story, is it? It's just about what, you know, bizarre thing can we throw at you in the next page. And it's a fun story.
Yeah, the opening page, which you'll see on the website, FrieandWaterPodcast.com, by Brunner, where Howard is falling through the interdimensional space, is gorgeous. I mean, it is, if you can forget that he's drawing a duck wearing a hat and a, you know, gloves and a coat and tie. I mean, this looks like a Doctor Strange story. It's got all the crazy, you know, interdimensional foo-for-all and stuff like that. I mean, Brunner is really, really bringing it. And I even love the way he draws. I love the way he draws Garko the Man Frog. I mean, draws this massive you know, frog creature. And then of course, yeah. And then, Gerber can't kind of help himself with a sort of downer ending that this after Garko gets transformed back into a, not back, but eventually devolves into a actual frog. He hops off and then runs right under the cop car and gets squished. And it's just kind of like a rah, rah, kind of ending. So it's just all like very 70s downer kind of thing.
The splat is probably my favorite part of the whole story, where it, that last panel where it just drips off the panel.
Yeah, the blood. Yeah, the blood is actually shooting past the panel border and stuff. Oh my lord! So, but again, beautifully drawn. I mean, Brunner is really, he inked his own work, and boy, it is just gorgeous, and it's really, really beautiful. So even just, and you know, I mean, drawing funny animals, especially when they are interrelating with humans. That's tough to do, because you got to make them look, Howard has to look like he's real. He's got weight. He's got solidity. Shadows fall on him the way they fall on like the kids that he surrounded. But yet Howard has got these ridiculously huge Disney eyes. I mean, he's got to look cartoony and, you know, kind of pleasurable to look at, but yet he's got to look like he fits in the same world as these regular people. So again, Brunner's just great, great work.
Yeah. It's almost like, you know, like the Sunday funnies, the comic, the newspaper strips, you have to, there's obviously a lot of those artists are, you know, are good at making things three-dimensional as well, but there's something about Howard that he has to be a little extra, not two-dimensional, so that it doesn't just look like a comic strip, you know, newspaper strip slapped into a more realistic comic book art. But yeah, it is a fine line, like you're saying. It's another, no pun intended, but
yeah.
You didn't talk about your history with Howard exactly. And do you have a favorite Howard artist?
I don't have much of a history like you. I didn't really see the comic as a kid. I was familiar with the character mostly when he would show up in other Marvel comics.
Yeah.
But I didn't really have the comic. And I think like you, if I had bought it, I must have bought one or two over the years, probably as Mountain Comics, because as I was buying more things, it probably just went over my head. You know, all the Gerber stuff, I was just like, all right, whatever. But he had come and gone before I really was that familiar with him. I saw the movie. I saw the movie in the theater. I paid to see the movie in the theater because I was like, all right, it's a Marvel Comics movie. I'll go see this.
Yeah, I think I did too.
Oh, Lord. Lordy, lordy, lordy.
Okay. Well, not to get up, and we might as well talk about the movie right now.
Why not? The terrible, terrible movie.
So, you know, I felt like it was my duty to watch the movie before we met up today.
Oh, wow.
And, really, well, you know, a little extra Howard research. I hadn't seen it in forever. Now, I own it on DVD. Rob, ask me why I own Howard the Duck, the movie, on DVD.
Why do you own Howard the Duck, the movie, on DVD?
I don't know. I because it was in a discount bin for like $3, you know, years ago. Did I watch the DVD? No, because that would have been too much effort. It was streaming for free on Peacock. So this is what happened. I started to watch the movie on Monday. I finished it on Thursday.
Wow.
I kept falling asleep. I watched it in 20 to 25 minute increments over 4 days.
Oof.
That's how bad that movie is.
Oof.
Or maybe that's just a testament to how pathetic I am at my age than how pathetic the movie is. But I hadn't seen it in so long. I didn't remember hardly anything about it, to be honest.
I saw it in the theater and I thought it was terrible. I remember there's the scene in like they go to like Howard's like a towel boy in like a sauna or something.
Yeah.
And like there's like footage of like people like grinding in the tub. And I, even at 15, I was like, what is this movie? Like who is this aimed at? And then then it became an infamous bomb. And then, I didn't see it again. I saw it once again about 20 years ago. It was one of those, like, is this any better? And I was like, no, I don't even think I got through it the second time. I watched, I think, like at 20 minutes, and I was like, this is just awful. I can't. Now, it's amazing to me that it's on Peacock, which is fun to say, and it's not on Disney Plus, because right? Disney, of course, owns it. But of course, Disney is probably like, no, no, no.
No, they're distancing themselves.
We're good. We're fine. We don't need to run that. It's amazing. That is the first ever Marvel Comics movie. It is the distinction of being the first one ever. I mean, there were Marvel movie serials, but in terms of movies created after the creation of the Marvel Universe with Fantastic Four number one, Howard the Duck is the first one.
It makes no sense. How did that happen?
No. And the other problem,
strange duck universe.
The other problem is in the world of the comics, when Howard and Bev clearly have a sexual relationship. I mean, they dance around it, but you know, it doesn't take a whole lot to read between the lines. They have a sexual relationship. You're like, how does that even work? Watching, it's one thing to see that in a comic book that's clearly meant as a satire. But when you see an actress actually have to perform, you know, poor Leah Thompson, actually have to put that across, it's horrifying, especially when she's talking to the Howard puppet slash costume that they came up with, which is not at all. He's got tiny little eyes. It doesn't really even look like Howard because they didn't animate it. They had to make it into a, you know, a costume for an actor to wear. It's just, it tonally, it's all over the place. And the fact that George Lucas put his name on it, he was really getting over his skis. And I think he, you know, I pretty much ruined the career of the two directors because they basically, I don't think they ever really worked again. They've been friends with Lucas. They worked on American Graffiti and they did, I think they did Radioland Murder, something. Everything they've been attached to has not been good, but it's, you know, rough
movie. The Howard costume is probably my favorite part of the whole movie. Like I don't get tired of watching Howard kind of do his thing. I think he looks kind of cool. He doesn't look anything like the comic book.
No.
You have to have CGI to have it, you know, a neck that thin and everything else. But I kind of like what they ended up doing with Howard. It's just, everything else is horrible.
Oh man. Oh God. It's just so awful. Now of course,
I wanted the secretary from Ferris Bueller's Day Off to show up and be like,
Edie McClure. Yeah, right. Because Jeffrey Jones is in this movie.
With your bad knee, you shouldn't be throwing in.
I mean, they have tried to, you know, as we know, the MCU has tried to reclaim Howard because, of course, he cameoed in Guardians of the Galaxy, voiced by Seth Green, who was on one of my episodes of Film and Water. And, of course, he's seen briefly in the Endgame, for Pete's sake. So, you know,
if there is a second coming of Howard the Duck, I mean, that would blow my mind if it just somehow it spiraled into another Howard movie.
They use, you know, I don't
or
think
a Disney, Marvel... a Disney television show, maybe on Disney Plus. Something.
Yeah, I can't see a movie. I cannot see a movie, but maybe, you know, a one-off episode of a TV show. I mean, now that they've got these shows on Disney Plus, they can do anything they want. So why not? Yeah. Why not give Howard a
one-shot? An animated Howard would be amazing. And supposedly that movie was meant to be animated. I read that originally it was intended as an animated film, but somehow that, I don't know exactly why, but that veered off into a live-action film.
It would have made more sense to be animated. It would have made much more sense. Although I guess in 1986, it would have been hard to sell an animated movie that wasn't for kids because everyone would have just thought. You know,
when did the heavy metal movie come out?
That's true. There was heavy. Yeah, that was 82, 81. That's true. They could have done it.
I mean, I don't know how big of a hit that was. Maybe not a huge hit or anything. But
yeah, no, you're right, though. I mean, there was precedent. There was the Bakshi Lord of the Rings, which wasn't for... it wasn't just for adults, but it wasn't like a little Disney kid movie either. So it would have worked better animated, no doubt, than the live action abortion.
Why put a duck on screen and then show a little duck condom in his wallet? I mean,
my God. It's just awful. All right, let's talk about something better. Let's talk about Hell Cow, which is the next story from Giant Size Man Thing number 5 by Gerber, Brunner, and the inker this time is Tom Palmer. Howard spends the night in jail, but is released when the commissioner discovers that Howard is not a little person in a duck suit, but an actual talking duck. Meanwhile, a local farmer is surprised to see a cow show up in his barn wearing a cape. Before he can investigate further, the cow bears a mouthful of fangs, killing him. The cow then transforms into a bat and flies off. Howard reads the newspaper about a series of farmer killings and, in need of a job, decides to investigate, figuring the cops will be so grateful if he solves the case, they'll hire him. After learning the origin of how a cow came to be a vampire, Howard meets Hell Cow, and they battle in the streets of Cleveland. Cops arrive after Howard has staked the blood-sucking bovine in the heart, but all they see is a dead cow, not a serial killer. The cops leave Howard screaming about the unfairness of it all. All right, so what did you think of Hell Cow Town?
It's fun. Again, I mean, you know, the artwork is my favorite part.
Yep.
There's some really, really great art. But, you know, Hell Cow, Man Frog, it's kind of, you know.
It's a theme here.
Well, speaking of themes, though, one of the things I do enjoy, I like the way Gerber, he liked to put character, Howard mostly, but put him in the, you know, other, in the place of other Marvel characters. Like in Howard the Duck number one, he's Conan, basically, you know. And
yeah.
Then in the original story for this Treasury, you see him in the Doctor Strange getup, which I just think is just so, so fantastic. But in this one, it's not Howard, it's the cow that's wearing Dracula's cape. And I mean, that's those little things like that just really, really make it fun for me.
I love in the flashback to how Hell Cow got created. First of all, hard to make a cow look scary, but Brenner manages to, because he gives it the horns and he kind of gives it drapes it in shadow. But I love in the flashback, they explain how the cow became a vampire cow is that the cow gets bitten by a vampire who was very thirsty, and it says, and not for milk. And you only see the vampire in one panel and they don't name him, but it is clearly the Tomb of Dracula. I mean, it looks exactly like the Marvel Dracula character, which I'm sure Marvel probably wouldn't be super happy with, but they couldn't resist having the idea that the Dracula that we saw in 70 issues of Tomb of Dracula created Hell Cow. So it's like, it's all connected in the Marvel universe.
And the fact that the farmer was so broken up about Bessie that he not only buried her, but she has her own tombstone.
He has her own tombstone. Bessie, it says on it. Yeah. I love it. And then she rises out of the grave, the zombie cow head with the red eyes. And, you know, she rises from the grave, the undead. Again, it's, you know, these Howard the Duck stories are, humor is tough to do in superhero comics, because it's like you can get too silly and then the whole thing kind of collapses, because, I mean, superhero universes are inherently silly. So then if you're underscoring the silliness, then you lose all the drama. But you know, with stories like this, Gerber's, you know, it's managing to get it right on the line. I love the panel of when the farmer discovers the cow in the cape in his barn. And the cow just has that look, like it just looks absurd with the big cape and stuff. But again, beautifully drawn by Brunner and Palmer. I mean, it's moody. The opening splash page is Howard in jail with the bars of the cell, the silhouetted against him. I mean, it's just a gorgeous looking story.
The page 61 of the Treasury, those jagged panels at the top of the page and the shadows with the, you know, with the
cops.
What do you call that? The sticky stuff that they use for that?
Oh, Zip-A-Tone.
Oh, the zip. Thank you. Zip-A-Tone.
Oh, it's beautiful.
I love the look of it. Yeah, it's fantastic. And unlike the original story, the first story in this Treasury, where you could tell they were probably rushing some of it a little bit, you know, not a lot of backgrounds. Here, like that picture with the cops, there's just a green background, but a lot of the panels have, you know, pretty detailed, you know, backgrounds. And
yep,
it looks fantastic.
It's really nice. One thing I noticed on the opening splash, written on the wall of Howard's cell, there's some graffiti and it says "Free the New York 8 million." And I Googled that because I was like, that's clearly an in-joke to somebody. And I could not find any information as to what that means. Now, obviously this is 1976. It might've been something that was in the news in 1976 and has long been lost to the mists of time. If anyone has any idea what that means, let me know in the comments, but that Brunner Gerber or Brunner or Palmer felt enough to put it in right where you can see it.
Well, when did the Free the New York 5 happen? What year was that? You know, there were those like kids that were, you know, up for murder, right?
And, right, but that was in the '80s.
Yeah, that was later. So yeah. They could have been playing off of something, but it's just funny. That's the thing about Gerber. Like there's broader satire that he'll do in a plot, but my favorite bits are the little micro satires that are from panel to panel. That's my favorite part of it. That's the little things that make me chuckle throughout the story. But just like that, you know, he's just throwing an aspersion towards the whole city of New York in that one little spot right there.
Yeah, it's really nice. So next up is a bonus feature, Know Your Candidate, which features an interview with Steve Gerber and Howard the Duck. And there's even a little drawing of Steve talking to Howard, and they're both smoking. And, you know, I don't know, your mileage may vary, Dallin. I don't know how I feel about writers inserting themselves into their stories. It feels, on the one hand, could be a little self-deprecating, but on the other hand, maybe a little self-aggrandizing that, you're not happy just writing the stories. You have to become a character in your thing. It's funny. I think the joke gets a little old. It's a whole page of them talking, and it's a little like, all right, it's cute, but, you know, maybe we didn't need a whole page of it or something.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, you know, Gerber had a history of, you know, at some point he put himself into the stories and trying to cross that line between like, is this real life that he's relaying or is this fiction? And with him, it's kind of a part of who he is as a writer. And I think it kind of works for him, but yeah, this is a little much, but it's the whole, you know, it's the Howard running for president thing. They kind of have to, lean into that a little bit extra for this.
Yeah. And so, well, speaking of leaning into it, there's another page, which I like a lot better. The Unsolicited Testimonials, featuring quotes from stars of the Marvel Universe about what they feel about Howard the Duck running for president. So we've got these little headshots of Captain America, Iron Man, Thing, Thor, Hulk, Doctor Strange, Daredevil, Luke Cage, Stan Lee, and then a blank face regarding the you Marvelite with quotes about what they feel about Howard running for president. And this is the kind of thing where, as we've talked about on a bunch of other episodes for across the years, I was definitely more of a DC kid than a Marvel kid, but I love Marvel comics. I did then and I do now. But one of the things Marvel was so much better at than DC was their sense of humor. When DC tried to be funny, a lot of the time it was, you know, really pretty stuff. I'm making a joke now. Ha ha. Marvel spared none of their characters to be part of the joke. You know, they would have Dr. Doom selling Marvel merchandise in the pages of Not Brannick. And here you've got, you know, presumably serious stars of the Marvel Universe with funny quotes about Howard the Duck running for president. So it's nobody was above being part of a gag.
No, they definitely try to do that. You know, that it was just all part of that chummy relationship between the bullpen and the readers, you know. And I mean, they had those funny stickers, you know, with the characters.
I had those.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Two all beef patties. Ridiculous, but so much fun and just drew you into the universe that much more.
Yep. Yep.
These are real people talking about a real duck that's really running for president, you know, nudge, nudge, wink, wink. But the whole thing is what makes Marvel. It's, you know.
I would love to have those stickers again. I really would. I really enjoyed those. Well, I had the whole set.
It's funny you say that. Are you not familiar with the book that was just put out last year?
No, what book is that?
There is a go to Amazon as soon as you're done with this podcast.
All right, well, let's hurry up. Come on. Talk faster.
It's a recreation of every one of those stickers in a
book. Oh, really?
Yes. And it's reasonably priced, and they're all in there. Get two so you can peel them off and start sticking the other one.
How is that even legal to make?
I don't know. I don't know. But I always wonder about Steve Gerber soliciting money from the readers.
I know, at the bottom. He asked for campaign contributions.
That's fascinated me for years. Did he just do it. And then Marvel was just kind of grumbled, like, I guess, like, was all that cash going to him? How much did he make? I really want to know how many campaign buttons he actually sent out. I would just love to know all this information. Send your money straight to the writer and, you know, for Howard's campaign. I just, it's brilliant.
Yeah. And as far as I know, the address that is listed there, 850 7th Avenue, that's not Marvel's address. So no. I don't know where that is. I'm wondering if that's a fake address. I don't know if that, you know, maybe that doesn't even really exist.
No, there's no way. It had to have been, it says room 806. It had to have been a P.O. box or something. He had to have been, you know, making good on these. People would be sending their money off into the void.
It's been known in comic books, for God's sakes. A lot of people probably sent Steve Gerber weed, I'm assuming. They probably did a lot of that, or maybe expecting to get weed in return. So
I think a lot of people sent a lot of weird things back then, because one of the things I read was that when people were demanding that the Howard character be brought back, he said that someone in Canada sent a duck carcass to the office.
Ooh. Oh. Okay.
And now I'm sorry I brought that up.
Yeah, that's somebody.
Why did you kill Howard? Well, we didn't really kill Howard, but somehow you've really killed a duck. Okay.
Oh, that's terrible. All right. Yeah. Okay. So let's wrap this up. We have the final story. I got to get to the sticker book. So this
episode deserves to be as absurd as possible.
That is true. Howard the Barbarian from Howard the Duck number one, which was, as we talked about, kind of hard to find on the newsstands. And in fact, on the cover, it even talks about that it reprints the sort of hard to find Howard the Duck number one by Gerber, Frank Brunner, and Steve Lealoha. So depressed, homeless, and alone, Howard the Duck strolls the edge of the Cuyahoga River. Disgusted by its polluted waters, he decides to end his life by throwing himself off a vast tower he sees in the distance. Once he arrives, though, he sees a strange building. The strange building is made up of credit cards. With no door to enter, he scales its walls and finds a beautiful, strangely dressed woman inside. She claims to be a prisoner and beseeches Howard to save her. Howard is attacked by a huge red-eyed dog, which turns back into a man once Howard knocks it out. Suddenly, a mysterious figure blasts Howard with some sort of energy, and when Howard wakes up, he is dressed as a barbarian. The mysterious being explains that he is a wizard named Pro Rata, who is attempting to balance the ledger sheets of the universe using a machine known as the Cosmic Calculator. Pro Rata transports Howard and the woman, whose name is Bev, to another dimension to retrieve a magical key. Pro Rata needs the key to work the machine, which will in turn cause an astral audit, resulting in a cosmic dividend. Got all that? Howard and Bev fight off various creatures to retrieve the key and get chased by a giant winged beast back into our dimension. Because this was the first issue of a new series, Spider-Man, on assignment from J. Jonah Jameson, gets involved. Pro Rata escapes. Spider-Man gives chase, leaving Howard and Bev back at the tower. So, okay, this was the first issue of Howard the Duck. It introduces Bev, who, of course, we've already met in the Defender story, but this is where Howard meets her for the first time. What did you think of this introductory? I mean, it's not that Howard the Duck first appearance, but it's his first issue. What do you think of this as a first issue story?
I think it's a lot of fun. It sets the tone for Howard. You know, again, there's that broader like satire that's running through the whole thing. This, you know, just credit cards and paying bills and just, you know, Gerber's just a guy who's, you know, rent is due just like everybody else. And, you know, but the fun parts of it are all the little things, you know. And of course there's a prerequisite Spider-Man appearance. Yep. For a first issue.
Yep.
Right. Spider-Man's got to be on the cover. And I love that they hearkened back to that in the first story when he ran into Peter Parker on the street. I mean,
yep.
That's one of my favorite things. I love that Peter had already interacted with Howard the Duck, and then neither Howard nor Beverly knew it.
Yep,
I think it's great.
Yep,
but yeah, it's a fun story. That this is not my favorite Howard artist, but it's still this is still some solid artwork.
Oh, it's marvelous. First of all, I mean, the cheesecake is great.
She's done up like, yeah, I mean, she's, you know,
like a Conan like princess kind of
Red Sonja or something. Yeah, I mean, you know, if you've got the sort of 2D, you know, comic strip character of Howard balanced out with the Bucks and Beverly, I mean, it's a winning combination.
Yeah, I love the way Spider-Man looks. I love this Pro Rata character. He's right out of the Marvel, you know, the Marvel playbook of terms of, like, you know, crazy demonic villains. And, you know, he's going on and on about the cosmic calculator and the astral audit. And, you know, again,
they make it look so sinister.
Yeah.
But the stuff that he's spouting is just so, you know, I guess it's not any crazier than anything Dr. Doom says, right? But
no.
But the fact that Gerber gives it that Gerber spin is just what makes it Howard magic.
Yeah, we see these giant statues come alive at one point. I talked about there's that giant sort of pterodactyl vulture. Again, the artwork by Brunner and Lee Aloha is just amazing. When the beast breaks out of the tower, there's this tall height-wise panel. I mean, it's just gorgeous. And then you've got these kind of really moody shots of Spider-Man. And there's even a point where he's talking to Howard, and it's Webfoot meets Webhead. And, you know, I mean, it's like, again, it's sort of amazing that Marvel was willing to let their number one marquee character kind of get involved in this nonsense. But, you know, as you say, it was like Spider-Man, he was always in the first issue. He's the Batman of Marvel Comics. He's always got to be in the first issue of, movie Wolverine now would be maybe that. But
I want to clarify my comment when I say he's not my favorite Howard artist. I just mean, I'm just talking about the character of Howard. He doesn't draw my favorite. I mean, he draws a great Howard, but it's not my absolute favorite Howard. But you can't argue with any of the rest of the artwork. I was just regarding, you know, just right. Referring to the way he draws Howard.
Who is your favorite Howard artist?
I was hoping you would ask me. I've alluded to it several times. I don't know. I really don't. I think it's Golan, but when I see Buscema's Howard, I have a tough time choosing.
Okay.
As far as like a complete issue, I probably have to go with Gene. But as far as just the way that Howard is drawn himself, it might be Buscema.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah. I said it's he's really was gifted by a lot of great artists. And so I would say this opening issue is a lot of fun, and you know that it's firmly entrenched in the Marvel universe, and he's going to meet a lot of these kinds of same ridiculous characters. I like the very little bit of social commentary that Howard dips one of his web feet into the Cuyahoga River, and it's full of sludge and filth, which the Cuyahoga River was. Caught on fire for Pete's sakes at one point. So, I mean, you know, that was something that was true to life. And they really do make the Cleveland look like Gotham City. In the opening pages. I mean, it's just this miserable burg and stuff like that. So like I said, it's enormous fun. You could see why, you know, it was, you know, unique, and that Marvel had a lot of humor, but you know, Gerber was sort of mixing all the tropes of the Marvel universe with the humor and sort of, you know, kind of synthesizing something new. You could see why Howard was such a sensation. Again, briefly running, but quite this. By the way, we didn't talk about it. Isn't it strange that the Howard the Duck movie came out, what, 5-10 years after nobody cared anymore about Howard the Duck? Like, yeah. What a weird time for them to put that movie out. Yeah, I mean, Howard the Duck was hot in 76, 77, 78, not 86. Like, what?
And, you know, Steve Gerber had been, he'd already been fired off of the, not just the comic book, but the comic strip.
Yep.
You know, and then of course there was the famous lawsuit, and the movie was after the lawsuit, right?
Yeah.
I mean, none of it makes any sense. It's just such a strange phenomenon. And, you know, Steve Gerber was just a weird dude, and Howard is basically, you know, plays the part of Steve Gerber in the stories, even though Steve Gerber's actually still shows up too.
Yep.
It's just, you know, like I said, the way that it all just evolved, none of it makes any sense.
No, I mean, right, this was after Pacific Comics published Destroyer Duck, the parody comic by Gerber and Jack Kirby. You know, two guys definitely sticking the thumb in the eye of their old employer. So yeah, it's a very, very strange,
you kind of just have history. You just kind of have to go Chinatown with it. You know, like it's Howard Jake, you know, just it's leave it Howard alone. The duck.
So one last thing I want to mention is the back cover, which we talked about, I referenced to earlier. It's a mirror image where the front cover is Howard and the Defenders coming at the camera. And now we see on the back cover where they're going. They are all marching to Howard the Duck campaign headquarters. They're all flying in the front door of Howard's headquarters. And for good measure, they've even stuck a patch on the Hulk's butt saying, "Get down, America." So there you go.
I think I like the back cover more than the front cover.
It's a unique image. That's for damn sure. You very rarely see figures drawn from these angles. It's really hard to draw these people from this angle.
Multiple crotch shots.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. It's a great back cover.
Yeah. I said it's a lot of fun.
One thing I wanted to mention that I thought was interesting. I totally forgot to mention it when we started the first story, but even though the first story is called The Duck and the Defenders,
yes,
when you open the book, the prologue has its own title on the very first page. You would think that it was the title of the whole story. But
Five Villains in Search of a Plot, yeah.
And anyone that's a Twilight Zone fan is familiar with the episode, the five... well, what now? What do they call it? Is it
five characters in a room?
Five characters in search of an exit.
Search of an exit. That's right. Because there's five people in a room.
I always knew that the exit part was kind of a reference to the play No Exit.
Right.
Where people are trapped in a room together and it's basically hell. But what I did not know when I started to investigate that title is that the Twilight Zone episode is not just influenced by No Exit, but it's influenced by an earlier play from the 20s, an Italian play that was called Six Characters in Search of an Author.
Oh, okay. I did not know that.
Stirling took Six Characters in Search of an Author, and he took No Exit, and he came up with Five Characters in Search of an Exit. But this is Steve Gerber obviously being familiar with the earliest source material, this weird play about this family that meets up with these troop of actors and stuff. But yeah, so Five Villains in Search of a Plot, like it's a funny title. It's totally Gerber. You know, he's on record as saying that the toughest thing for him to write was always the next issue blurb at the bottom of the last page, you know, next issue. And because he didn't work that far ahead. Usually he didn't know what the next issue was going to be. He didn't know where he was going, you know, which is why his writing is so, you know, sporadically good or sometimes really, really bad. But I love that title, the five villains in search of a plot, because Steve Gerber was usually himself in search of a plot, just kind of making it up as he went along, you know. And but you know, he was a learned writer. I'm sure he took that straight from the source material. I thought that was pretty interesting.
It's a deep cut reference for the average comic book fan in 1976, right? That's for sure. So that is the Howard the Duck treasury. Dallin, thank you so much for coming back to the show to talk about this. I mean, I don't know if the Defenders have ever made another appearance in a Marvel treasury. We'll have to go and look them up, but if they have, we'll have to get you back for that one, because that seems to be the recurring theme through your appearances here on the show.
If I'm going to be pigeonholed, let it be with the greatest non-team to ever exist.
There you go. Perfect. So, well, again, Dallin, thanks so much for coming back. Thank I appreciate you, it. Why don't you tell people where they can find you out on the internet?
I'm usually hopping around various porn sites. That's where you can find me. Oh, you mean like my, oh, sorry, my, no, I am basically Dallin B, at Dallin B on Twitter. That's where I am. My Facebook account got hacked months ago. I still can't get into that, son of a, but it doesn't matter. I love Twitter. I'm always on Twitter.
All right. Have you tried Meta? No. But yeah, you can find Dallin over on Twitter. He's always tweeting lots of fun.
But right now, I'm just hanging out here at the cabin overlooking the lake, drinking some
new food. We're crossing our shows down. Hold on. So we'll
sorry,
get you.
I keep doing that.
Yeah, we'll get you on next year for Mountain Comics, I promise. So so thanks everybody for listening. Stay tuned. I'm gonna run some podcast promos.
Wait a minute.
Yes?
Wait a minute.
I got to buy this book, Dallin. Hurry up. Come on.
I know. And I'm telling you, you're going to be so happy you did. It'll be on your doorstep tomorrow. But I just have to mention, you're doing God's work. You're doing God's work, Rob Kelly. Thank you very much for putting out such quality entertainment.
All right. I'm taking all this out. All right. Thank you. So, everybody, as I was saying, we're going to play some podcast promos. And when I come back, I'm going to do some listener feedback.
Need a podcast talking about weird stuff? Well, then we've got just the thing for you. Into the Weird, a podcast chronicling the madness and magnificence of the mighty Marvel Bronze Age of comics, featuring the voice talents of Mr. Billy Delicious.
Hola.
Mr. Herman Hellstrom Lowe.
Hey there.
And straight from the long box of darkness, his infernal majesty Dormammu.
How are you?
And many more. But wait a minute. You might be thinking, aren't all comics infused with a grain of weirdness? I mean, Reed Richards can stretch every single part of his body, right? And why did Ultron design the Vision with working genitalia? Well, you would be correct, but Into the Weird isn't just any regular comic book show, folks. We focus on the really bizarre. Here are a few examples.
A sword and sorcery barbarian grown spontaneously from a jar of peanut butter.
A duck running for president of the United States.
Benjamin Franklin playing hide the sausage with Doctor Strange's girlfriend, Clea.
A giant-sized man-thing lamenting the death of a clown.
A serial killer obsessed with killing only fools, dressed as cavalier with laser guns after witnessing a priest fornicating.
And so much more. So if you like the wonderful weirdness of the Bronze Age from 1970 to 1985, and characters such as Ghost Rider, Morbius, The Defenders, Man-Thing, Son of Satan, Skull the Slayer, Killraven, Howard the Duck, and the weird granddaddy of them all, Dr. Stephen Strange, then this is the show for you.
ITW's on iTunes, Stitcher, Podbean, and TuneIn. Hit subscribe and join us for a comic-filled jaunt into the weird.
Welcome, one and all, to the Fire and Water Racetrack and Arena. Please direct your attention to the center of the track, where you will see 36 buses lined up between two ramps, a tank full of live man-eating sharks, and a high wire stretching over it all. The rocket cycle is warmed up and all the nets have been removed. Who would attempt these stunts just to entertain and inspire his audience? What kind of man? What kind of hero? There, coming in on a rocket-powered skateboard, it's the death-defying human Flycast! Join me, Max Romero, and a rotating roster of guests as we dive headfirst into the colorful comics of Marvel's The Human Fly. The Death-Defying Human Flycast is a limited episode podcast spotlighting the adventures of a man who comes back from a crippling auto accident to become a mysteriously masked stuntman with a mission to inspire others to never give up hope. We'll also talk about the real-life Human Fly, a daredevil with a murky past and a desire to be the best stuntman in history, until the day he just disappeared. The actual Human Fly would vanish as suddenly as he had materialized, but not before sparking a comic series featuring what would be the wildest superhero ever. Because he was real. The Death-Defying Human Flycast. Coming soon to the Fire and Water Podcast Network. It's gonna be wild.
And it's time for listener feedback, and these are the comments we got on the previous episode of Treasury Cast, number 62. Welcome back, Cotter, with my guest, Brian Heiler. First up is Captain Entropy, who says, I have a note from Epstein's mom that says I can skip work to listen to this. Thank you, Captain. Matt Saroy says, I am a huge fan of Welcome Back, Kotter. My brother and I covered the TV series for our podcast. I've only read the first four issues of the comic book, and I absolutely agree that the art is a perfect blend of cartoonish caricature and realistic depiction of the actors. The writing is also very well done. As I read the dialogue, I could absolutely hear the actors reading it as they would as the characters. The theme song was written for the show. In fact, they changed the show's title from Kotter to Welcome Back, Kotter, in order for it to fit. Songwriters were having great difficulty rhyming Kotter. I did not know that. Thank you, Matt. As for whether or not the Augie Borelli story could have been an episode, I have to disagree with you. The show had a couple of rather gritty episodes. In fact, the show did indeed do an episode where the character of Hotsy Totsy claims that she is pregnant and that one of the Sweat Hogs is the father. The fourth season has an episode where the Sweat Hogs sneak into a strip club and discover Hotsy's become a stripper after dropping out of high school to support herself and her baby. There was also a Christmas episode where the Kotters and the Sweat Hogs help out a homeless man, buying him a suit and finding him a job. The episode ends with the man back on the street because, as he explains to the Sweat Hogs, a bum is who he is. Bambi was a short-lived character in the show who did indeed attempt to seduce Mr. Kotter. Okay, I've rambled on long enough about my beloved show. It was a huge hit for its first two seasons but fell hard for the third and fourth. Oops, guess I had some rambling left. The cover of this Treasury is amazing. Sure, it's way more madcap than the show was. This cover could be more fitting for a show like Police Squad or Scrubs. I could spend hours looking at it. It's truly a joyful piece of comic art. Thanks for the corrections, Matt. I will straight up admit, I only watched Welcome Back, Kotter sparingly as a kid, and I have not really seen it since. So I was probably a little unfair about saying what the show would have tackled and what it didn't. And to be fair to my, when I was quoting to Isabella, as he said in the quote, and he wanted me to reiterate, he didn't really remember the story exactly, right? Because, of course, we're talking 45 years ago. So no criticism intended on Welcome Back, Kotter. And it's interesting to know about those plots that you mentioned. I never would have guessed the show did anything like that. So, again, thank you for the information. Chris Franken, of course, from our network, says, great show, guys. I've been tempted to buy this Treasury in the wild a few times, but the price is always sky high for some reason. Is it that rare? Or do dealers just want to charge a premium because it's different? I don't know, but now that I know the content inside is so good, I would be looking out for a good deal on it. I was a big fan of Kotter as a kid. I would mimic Horshack a lot with the laugh and the ooh, and all that. I think I probably watched most of it in early syndication because by the time I would have really remembered the network broadcast, the show was probably on its last legs and Travolta-less and Kaplan-less. Brian's story about using Sweat Hog phrases to amuse his parents reminds me of how my parents would encourage me to imitate Fonzie at an early age with an ee. I even had a leather jacket. So yes, as Brian said, Fonzie mania was quite real. And in some ways, Kotter was like a contemporary version of that show. So that's probably why merchandisers smelled money around the license. I appreciate the kind words from two of my favorite people. I'm blushing. And I look forward to contributing to Toy Ventures again. You guys go check that magazine out. It's pure joy in print form. True enough, Chris. And by the way, I should mention, Brian Hyler, my guest on that episode, has announced a new book project. I don't want to, he's already announced what it is, so I'm not spoiling anything. But go to his Plaid Stallions page on Facebook or on the website and go check out what it is. It sounds like a really, really fun book. David S. Gutierrez says, Juan Epstein was the greatest character on television in my household until I saw Chico and the Man. Edo Boznar says, oh yeah, a wonderful Treasury cast as usual. I'm just old enough to remember occasionally watching the show during its original run with my older sister and brother. I was about 6 or 7 during its first season. However, at that point, I wasn't absorbing much of it except the catchphrases like up your nose, etc., which were obviously repeated by all the kids in school. And some of the older kids even came up with creative R-rated versions, like one involving a piece of glass and, well, the rhyming part of the human anatomy. Later, when I was in my teens and I watched the show quite a bit in syndication and gained a great appreciation of it and Mrs. Kotter. The comics I've never read, though. I remember occasionally seeing the regular series on the spinner racks, but was never interested in picking it up because I figured it was just a typical bland comic book adaptation. Now, I'd really like to read it because over the years, and not just here, I've heard good things about it. It's too bad that there's very little chance it'll ever be collected and reprinted in a trade or hardcover. By the way, interesting that you mentioned finding the Kotter books in the Whitman 3-packs. When I was growing up, I only ever saw those with DC reprints, and I never, ever remember one of them containing Welcome Back, Kotter. You know, Ado, as I said, my memory could be fuzzy on that, as it is on a lot of things at this point, but it's, you know, as they say, with print the legend. Matt Ev says, yay, Treasury cast. A curious subject, this one. Welcome Back, Kotter is not something I ever encountered or even heard of growing up in the UK. The Wikipedia tells me it did, in fact, air in the early 80s. Given that I watched every bit of US TV I could get my grubby little paws on at that age, I'm surprised it passed me by. The first time I ever heard of it was in the early 2000s when I discovered that one of my favorite bands, Mr. Bungle, used to cover the theme tune in their live shows. The second time I encountered it was this episode of Treasury Cast. Still, this episode was a blast. It gave me a weirdly nostalgic feel, reminding me of being a kid obsessed with US TV and US culture, gleaning little tidbits of information from peanut strips and ads in the back of Marvel Comics. Second, and more importantly, Rob, I'm glad you were intrigued and excited about the Fantastic Four Winter Special, but I fear I may have massively oversold it. And then having pulled it off the shelf for a few years and not generally having much sense of scale, I just checked my copy against my only Treasury edition, Heaven's Ladder, and discovered it's not quite Treasury size. It's definitely bigger than a regular comic, but it'd be more accurate to call it magazine or tabloid format with a sturdier, glossy cover. But then when I open it up, I note that the comic is actually reprinted at exactly the same size as the regular US comic with massive margins around the sides. So while it's an interesting curio, I wouldn't exactly rush out to grab one. Yeah, thank you, Matt. I didn't actually have time to go look for it on eBay between recording these episodes of Treasury Cast. It's a little disappointing because I just would have been so excited at a Treasury-sized Fantastic Four roast, but alas, it wasn't meant to be. Thank you for following up. Jonathan says, was that a reference to Red's, my childhood Brooklyn toy store? The front half of the store was toys and the back half was pool supplies. Whenever I get a toy that smells like rubber / vinyl, I say it smells like the back of Red's. Brett Young says, welcome back, Cotter. Always brings me back to my childhood. My dad was a teacher and head basketball coach at Thaddeus Stevens College of Technology in Lancaster, PA. This was a 2-year trade school where every student was either an orphan or lost at least one parent. My dad taught and coached a lot of kids who were definitely in the mold of the Sweat Hogs. I got to know many of his students when I was a little kid while I sat in his brown and beige office. Everything in the late 70s, early 80s was a shade of brown, and drew cartoons. So there was always a story to be told. One of my most vivid memories was my dad's starting point guard was afraid of driving over bridges. So for road games, they'd have to stop the team bus when they got to the bridge and let him run across, then pick him up on the other side. If it was a major bridge that would take too long to run across, the other players would jump him and cover him with towels so he didn't panic. Good player, though. What was this about? Oh, yeah, Rob, you should have dropped that $50 and gotten the Travolta to sign the book. You probably just wasted the $50 on an Aquaman statue. Good point, Brett. Yes, I should have done it. It would have been great for the story. And yes, that $50 that I was trying to save long ago disappeared. And then finally, Matt Sirois, I guess, could not help himself and followed up with another comment on the gallery page talking about the cover, which he was mooning over in his previous comment. And then he says, I don't normally comment on the gallery posts, but wow. I mean, I love this wraparound cover. So entertaining. So many questions. Who's responsible for that baby sitting in the puddle with two bottles set up behind him? Who's the unfortunate individual drowning in the sewer? Is that woman taking off her clothes to play in the fire hydrant? Is the dog biting the cop in league with the burglar sneaking out of the window behind them? Is that Big Bird in the window between Cotter and Vinny? What is that black cat planning? He's definitely up to something. Here are just a few of the amazing things going on in this cover. Yeah, as we said on the episode, it's an amazing wraparound cover by Bob Ochsner. It's just a thing of beauty. Those wraparound covers, man, those were gorgeous things from those Treasury editions. And I'm glad that Welcome Back Cotter got the wraparound treatment. So that is going to do it. Thanks everybody for the comments. I really appreciate it. Big thanks to Dallin Baumgartner for turning to Treasury Cast and covering Howard the Duck with me. That was a lot of fun. So that is going to do it for this episode of Treasury Cast. Of course, you can find back episodes of the show on our website, findwaterpodcast.com. We're always talking treasuries over on Twitter at Treasury Comics. You can subscribe to the show on any podcatcher of your choice. And then finally, if you want to support the Findwater Podcast Network, let's go to patreon.com/FW Podcast. And there you can unlock various rewards, one of which is to be name checked on a show of your choice. So big thanks to Jeff Pollier and Brett Young for their support of Treasury Cast. I very much appreciate it. Like I said, that's going to do it this month. Thanks everybody for listening. We will see you next month. But until then, go big or go home.
You know, he's the most exciting individual I've ever met. He isn't into the whole macho thing, but he knows who he is and what he wants. Everyone thinks of him as a hero now. But I share his feelings, and he's touched my soul. And right now, I would give anything to run my fingers through his feathers.
George Lucas presents an electrifying new comedy, Howard the Duck. More adventure than humanly possible.